Support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Indiana Pacers surprised the Pistons last night in Detroit 83-68, evening the NBA's Eastern Conference Finals at two games apiece. Detroit established a new franchise low for points in a home playoff game. Game 5 of that series is tomorrow night in Indiana. In the Western Conference Finals, the Lakers take a 3-1 lead over the Timberwolves into tonight's game in Minnesota. The National Hockey League Stanley Cup Final moves to Calgary tonight. There the Flames will try to take a 2-1 lead over the Tampa Bay Lightning. Joining me now on the line to discuss same is Helene Elliott of the Los Angeles Times, our high honcha of the head deke and warbling wren of the waffle pad. Helene, welcome back to Only a Game.
How you doing?
Very well, thank you. The finals are tied at 1 game apiece as Tampa Bay regained momentum on Thursday with a 4-1 victory. Does Tampa maintain that momentum on the road?
Tampa figures to be the better team, and they, you know, you just look at them, and that team is deeper. There's more talent. But, I mean, Calgary, the way they've played this whole playoffs, it's one of these, you know, you hate to use those cliches, the team of destiny.
I can hear the throbbing violins in the background.
I was just going to say, cue the music, you know, the whole thing. They've been so scrappy and just found ways to score goals and all that you really can't count Calgary out. Plus, at home, it's just going to be incredible for them. I mean, they've become Canada's team. I mean, even Edmonton Oilers fans have kind of grudgingly started rooting for them because they're the last Canadian-based team left in the playoffs. And it's just been an incredible thing, and I think they're going to get a huge, huge lift at home.
Well, everybody's talked about that huge lift at home, and yet Calgary has gone 9-3 so far on the road in these playoffs. What's been going on? Have all those people in the red shirts been traveling with them?
Who can figure it out, eh? You know, it used to be that you had this great home ice advantage because everybody's rinks were different. And, you know, Chicago Stadium had a smaller neutral zone. And Boston Garden was so quirky with the fans, you know, right over the benches. And now all these arenas are the same. There's no advantage anymore. You could be playing almost anywhere in North America, and you just don't have that great home ice advantage you used to have. And I think that's taken a lot out of the game.
Normally, the cities of Tampa Bay and Calgary are not really considered to be fierce rivals in anything, especially hockey, but these two teams have been pretty physical. Several fights broke out late in Game 2. Do we see things getting more chippy from here on out, or does old-timey hockey prevail?
Old-time hockey, eh? Once you get into it a little deeper and you start to develop all these little grudges and imagined slights, the emotions get a little more intense, and obviously as you get closer to the end of it and more at stake, the emotional level will ratchet up a couple of notches, and yeah, it could be a little bit more chippy. And I mean, they're both kind of physical teams. They can be, and those kind of things can happen.
The common perception was that a Stanley Cup final between Calgary and Tampa Bay would result in just abysmal television ratings, even by hockey standards. But here's your chance to tell the vast audience listening to Only a Game right now what makes this series worth watching.
What makes it worth watching is that these guys play hockey. They don't sit back and trap. If one team scores a goal, the game isn't over. I mean, I always had the feeling watching the New Jersey Devils that if they scored a goal, you could just go home because you knew that they were going to just fall back and defend. But with these teams, somebody scores a goal and it's like, okay, you know, now they're starting to get going. They skate. They hit. There's speed involved on both sides. There's a really good amount of grit involved on both sides. I mean, both coaches are slightly nuts, which I think is one of the requirements for success in the NHL. And it's interesting to watch the dynamics. For people who are real hockey fans who are going to watch this Stanley Cup Finals anyway, it's going to be a great series. Whether it draws other fans, I greatly doubt it, but I think it's going to be a terrific, fun series to watch.
Once again now, we've reached the point of the interview where we call on your powers of puck prognostication. And you've already said nice things about each team. Which one wins?
Oh, no. I think I've been so consistently wrong throughout all of this.
Well, that's kind of a requirement for analysts on this program.
Oh, do I get some kind of plaque for that?
Probably.
Cool. You know, logic tells me Tampa Bay. They just seem to be the better team. But at this point, I'm not sure logic has much to do with it. I mean, I just think Calgary is just riding this incredible wave of emotion. I would still say Tampa in seven.
All right. It may be the last cup anybody wins for a while. The collective bargaining agreement between owners and players will expire before next season. The two sides don't seem to be any closer to reaching a new agreement, and many predict there won't be any agreement until the 2004-2005 season is lost. What do you think? Can next season be saved?
So does that mean you won't call?
Of course I'll call. I mean, we'll have to find something to talk about. Pee-wees, I don't know, mites, midgets, squirts.
There you go. The World Junior Championships are going to be in North Dakota. Come on.
There you go.
I really have very, very grave doubts that there will be a season. In fact, I'm pretty much convinced that there will not be any hockey before December or January, if at all. The economic differences, there's just this level of distrust. And the Players Association just remains steadfast in saying the league wants a salary cap. We will not discuss anything involving a salary cap. And Commissioner Bettman says, well, there's other ways to get cost certainty than salary caps, or he won't even say the word salary cap, but there's other ways to get cost certainty, yet there really hasn't been any way put forward that would even hint at any kind of agreement.
Helene Elliott is the Fraulein of the Forecheck, not to mention Our Lady of the Frozen Lake. Helene, thank you again.
Thank you.
Pessimism about the future of the National Hockey League notwithstanding, fans of the game can no doubt still muster enthusiasm for the series currently matching the Lightning and the Flames. But can fans in the tropics really be as passionate as fans in Calgary? From member station WUSF in Tampa, Bobby O'Brien has this report.
Amid gently swaying palm trees, a pastel sunset reflecting off the nearby canal and 80-degree temperatures, thousands crowd the plaza outside the St. Pete Times Forum an hour before Game 1 of the Stanley Cup Finals. Dressed in his Calgary Flames jersey, Jim Taylor eyes the sea of blue, silver, and black Lightning shirts and questions if the typical Tampa Bay fan understands the prestige of the Stanley Cup.
I think the ones that are here from northern United States and Canada get it. I don't think a lot of the ones that lay on the beach every day get it. Our cab driver today told us he doesn't even know what hockey is.
In Calgary, cab drivers are some of the biggest hockey fans, but Taylor says they're not the only ones excited to be in the finals.
Calgary's a hockey city, it's a Canadian city, and we haven't been to the playoffs in 8 years. I've never seen the city so excited. There's flags, Calgary Flames flags on every car in the city. One out of four cars has a flag on it. Everyone's excited, the parties are insane at night, and every night the city's alive, and it's unbelievable. There's 15,000 people outside the stadium when the games are going, whether they're going to the game or not.
Lightning player Martin St. Louis says hockey is religion in Canada and entertainment in Florida. When asked, St. Louis provided a primer on how Florida fans could match the intensity of Canadian fans.
Watch less wrestling. No, I mean, they're passionate. It's different ways, you know. Hockey in Canada, they know the game. This is still pretty new in Florida, but they like the energy. I'll tell you what, though, they don't yell as much as in Canada, shoot the puck when you get the puck on the power play.
Lightning coach John Tortorella says there's just one reason Tampa has gotten turned on to hockey.
It's not friendly to hockey, it's friendly to winning. And let's call a spade here. Fans want to see their team win. And I think the fans here, I think it's a great sports town. But they're not going to keep on coming out, no matter what anybody says to you, if you continue to lose.
But there are signs that winning isn't everything. A full-time ice complex opened here 7 years ago. Chris Weed is assistant manager of the Ice Sports Forum of Brandon, the Lightning's practice facility.
There are so many people moving here from up north that love the game, and that's something they play for life. And so they come here and they play, and we have pickup games. But I do think the spur of the Lightning doing well, you've got a lot more people that moved here that were Flyer fans or Red Wing fans who are now converting to Lightning fans because they are the hometown team.
The forum hosts 60 adult hockey teams and more than 500 children playing in leagues. And Lightning players like Vinny LeCavier believe eventually Florida fans will develop the fervor Canadians have for the ice sport.
Why not? I mean, it's really the first time to get the opportunity and a little bit of the taste of how it is to win in hockey. I mean, they've seen it with football, and now they're seeing it with hockey. Why not? I mean, it's a great city for hockey, and people love it.
Former coach of the Hartford Whalers and Canadian TV hockey analyst Pierre McGuire says it is only natural for Canadians to scrutinize newer hockey towns like Tampa.
I think the passion level is something that all Canadian fans look for whenever they're evaluating their cousins to the south. And, you know, one of the things that's been a little bit disappointing is Canada lost a team in Quebec City, and they lost a team in Winnipeg. And, you know, people look at how the Phoenix Coyotes have had a tough time, and they've had a tough time selling tickets, and they're happy for the Colorado Avalanche. But they really wish that they had teams in those cities.
Bob Allion was the 98th person to buy season tickets in 1992, the Lightning's first season. He takes no offense when critics say Tampa is not a hockey town.
That's okay. Those people can believe whatever they want. We're in the Stanley Cup. Whether or not we're a hockey town, call us a weather town, a beach town, whatever, you name it. We're Stanley Cup contenders. How many other people would like to be here right now?
For Only a Game, I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
I said we're happy when we're winning. Ooh, yeah. When we lose, we're not grinning. Oh, no. All we want today. Yeah, we're happy when we're winning. One more fellas a cappella we want today. Hip hip hooray. Yeah, we're happy when we're winning. One more in the Vegas now we want today. Hip hip hooray. Yeah, we're happy.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Subateo, the tabletop soccer game, would not be nearly as intriguing without Tom Taylor's addition. Mr. Taylor introduced a streaker to the game, as well as a police officer to chase him or her off the pitch. Taylor, who runs a shop in Wales dedicated to Subateo, the world's only such shop, describes the streakers as, quote, anatomically perfect. At any time during a match, a Subateo player can place his streaker in the penalty area, thus halting play. You can use the streaker if your opponent has only to tap the ball into an unguarded net, Taylor says. Mr. Taylor claims he has sold Subateo streakers on every continent but Antarctica, because there, he supposes, it's too cold. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, all hail Zeus, god of thunder. But first, lawyers postured, athletes trained, and analysts, well, analyzed. But no one was banned from the Olympics this week by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. Still, the ongoing investigation into who took what from whom continues to raise questions about the legal rights of athletes and the challenge of cleaning up the Olympics in the absence of positive drug tests. University of Texas professor and sports doping expert John Hoberman joins us on the line from his office in Austin. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks very much.
John, this week officials at USADA, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, were relatively quiet, but the attorney representing Marion Jones showed the world various documents that he'd obtained from USADA. He claimed the initials MJ on what appeared to be a schedule for taking various substances could have stood for any number of names, including Michael Jackson. The attorney also scoffed at a ledger which contained the name Marion J and notations such as post four doses and 4 days on. What's the legal tactic behind releasing these documents now?
There is a propaganda war going on in the press. In a way, I think it's a game of chicken. The USADA officials are hoping that Marion Jones is going to crack under the pressure. Her lawyers are playing it bravely. They are apparently convinced that USADA is not holding the kind of testing evidence that ostensibly implicated Kelly White in THG doping. So at this point, you've got a real even kind of war of willpower on both sides going on.
Well, the evidence may or may not turn out to withstand legal scrutiny, but already it's been enough to cause at least one track meet to uninvite Ms. Jones and Tim Montgomery as well. So could this tactic cost Jones her popularity, if not her career?
Well, one informed, experienced law professor at Duke, Jim Coleman, is in the papers these days saying that, in effect, Marion Jones' reputation has already been destroyed. Then there is the whole question of her livelihood. For years, athletes have contested doping positives and doping sanctions on the grounds that it is illegal and illegitimate to deprive them of their livings, running on tracks or throwing the shot or whatever it happens to be. And I think one point that the public really doesn't get is the degree to which these people who dope, many of them, are simply trying to survive economically. They don't feel good about doing it. They wouldn't do it if they didn't feel they had to do it. This is absolutely true of the professional cycling culture in Europe, and I'm certain that it's true of a significant number of athletes in North America.
There's reason to believe that USADA has even more evidence against other athletes, including the aforementioned Tim Montgomery, Marion Jones's partner. Why aren't more athletes or their lawyers speaking out at this point?
I think that they are trying to keep a low profile. Certainly athletes who are well aware that they have been using illicit substances or that they have been doing something that might be construed by USADA or by the public as dubious, they want to stay out of the line of fire. Elite athletes are never candid about their drug use, except in the most exceptional cases, such as the Spanish cyclist Jesus Manzano, who is singing in Spain in recent weeks and months. I mean, that's the exceptional case. Very interesting testimony, but he is the rarity.
USADA has said that it can ban athletes based on evidence, quote, beyond a reasonable doubt, short of a positive drug test. But there's no jury here, and the normal rules of the courtroom may or may not be applicable. How do you understand reasonable doubt in this context?
That is a difficult question. And clearly, the people at USADA are going to define reasonable doubt at their convenience. It is perhaps no accident that the head of USADA is a former district attorney. But my greater concern is what the shorting of standards for proof in the sports world with respect to doping offenses might do in terms of eroding our sense of due process. Is it really the case that making sure that athletes do not cheat in foot races should be allowed to abridge the rights of all of us to due process and to a civilized definition of beyond a reasonable doubt? What I don't want to see in the current situation is the anti-doping campaign absorbed by the more mindless variant of the war on drugs in such a way that we wind up with hysteria as opposed to a more reasoned approach to disciplining athletes who drug themselves.
Currently, athletes who are banned from competition do have a limited right to appeal, but it's a process that can take years. Short of convincing more athletes to voluntarily accept bans, can USADA really expect to resolve these cases before the Olympics?
No, not if you have a certain number of self-confident athletes who are served by self-confident attorneys. The Olympic trials are coming up, I believe, on July 9th. That is a very short time in which to adjudicate all the potential cases. USADA is holding its cards close to its chest. It is implying in the press that they may have dozens of people on hooks of one size or another. It's a terrible problem for the public image of the sport. It is virtually impossible to handle these cases in a way that is going to respect the legal rights of Americans as we have come to understand them, and at the same time to present the public with credible evidence that they have cleaned drugs out of Olympic sport.
John Hoberman is a professor at the University of Texas, and he's the author of many books, including Mortal Engines. His new book, Testosterone Dreams, is due out in January. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was a pleasure to talk with you.
For fans who wish for a simpler Olympics, one free of lawsuits, controversy, and nearly unpronounceable chemical compounds, we present the 17th annual Waldorf School Olympics. Waldorf schools are private institutions based on philosopher Rudolf Steiner's educational theories, and every spring, fifth graders from 500 such schools around the world celebrate their own version of the ancient Olympic Games with running, jumping, and the throwing of dangerous objects. Last week, Only a Game's Karen Given met up with fifth graders from six New England Waldorf schools in Lexington, Massachusetts.
I would like to welcome you all here and thank Zeus and the gods for this beautiful day. Give it a big round of applause. We have participants from New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Cape Cod, the North Shore.
My name is Ralph Brooks. I'm the athletic director here at the Waldorf School. They will be doing the reenactment of the pentathlon, which is the five events: javelin, discus, running event, long jump, and wrestling. They will receive a laurel wreath for form and beauty, as well as strength and distance.
Now we will have our offerings to Zeus, Host School Lexington.
Glorious Apollo, from on high beheld us, wandering to find the temple for his grace.
And we have an actual torch that was made by one of our fifth grade students, and they will pass the baton from school to school to school, coming to the end. One of our students will climb the ladder, light the torch, let the games begin.
Now, you've got to trust your students a lot. You let them run around with fire?
They're running around with fire, and they have a lot of fire in their blood. And that's the wonderful thing about it.
I do solemnly swear.
I do solemnly swear.
By all Father Zeus.
By all Father Zeus.
Tara Danatale, the fifth grade teacher here at the Waldorf School in Lexington.
I will not argue.
I will not argue.
The part in the oath about not arguing.
Yes.
Was that added in for modern children?
This oath was made up by a teacher who was used to be here at this school. So I'm assuming that he made it up based on his own experience. I would say yes. This is definitely a modern adaptation of the oath to Zeus.
They've done two intensives on ancient Greece. We started with ancient Greek mythology. We also really went into the Greek mind, the Greek state of thinking, the importance of beauty and truth and grace. We've been working with that in many different ways in the curriculum, and then it all culminates in today.
So if I were to ask your students to, say, give me a history lesson about the original Olympics, do you think they'd be able to do it?
Yes, I think so.
So help me, Zeus.
So help me, Zeus.
Thank you, Tom.
Go, Annie!
I'm Annie!
Woo!
I'm looking for some kids who can tell me about the original Olympics.
Okay. At the very beginning of the Olympics, there was not very many events. They were just running, and that's it. And after many years, there became javelin, discus, boxing, and a lot of other events.
The dwelling place of the gods was on Mount Olympus, and the games happened in Olympia in honor of Zeus and the other gods.
Zeus is the all-father god in the Greek myths. He throws thunderbolts from the sky.
Ready, set!
Well, I know in the very ancient times they were actually naked when they did the Olympics. They had a three-hop jump where they'd hop three times and they'd jump because in war they had to go over stuff because they're in Greece. There wasn't roads and stuff, so they had to hop over. So that was good training. And then there wasn't any vehicles, so you had to run.
The discus was one of the ancient sports in the Olympics, and people would throw it naked. And also the Olympic truces that all countries who were at war would stop warfare and all hold hands in a way and not fight war.
I see that now you get to wear clothes when you throw the discus.
Yes, that's a fortunate sign, yeah.
All clear.
all the countries in Greece would come to Athens and compete there, and it would be a really big event. The rich people would come with their slaves and all their food and be carried, and the poor people would be they would have to walk, and it took 5 days, the whole Olympics. They couldn't wear hats, they couldn't put anything over their heads, because then Zeus was looking down on them, and he couldn't see them, so that'd be just putting shame to Zeus. And the people, if you can imagine, for standing 5 days in the sun without any sunblock or anything.
And you were going to tell me about Hercules?
Just a little bit. He was the greatest hero in Greece, and he wanted other people to be like him. He wanted to see if there's make a contest, so he came up with the Olympics.
Do you know when Hercules made the first Olympics, did he win?
Yes.
Go!
All right, I'm hoping to do a little fact-checking here, because I've heard a lot of things.
I'm sure.
Now, here's one I hadn't heard before. Someone told me that it was Hercules who started the games.
That is one of the legends. That's the mythology, that Hercules did it as he was showing his prowess. But the ancient games were a running race, strictly a running race. So I think that was added on after, because Hercules did all kinds of things in the Olympics. There are many different stories. Sometimes it was a modern-day author who changed the story, and sometimes the old stories from different parts of Greece, because Greece was not united, they had their own stories about who did what, depending on where you lived. But it's hard to say what's actually true, much like modern times. We all write our own stories of current events.
Our visit to the Waldorf Olympics was produced by Karen Given. One more note, the athletes at the Athens Olympics in August, which will commemorate the first modern Olympiad of 1896, will be fully closed when they compete. You're listening to Only a Game. A lot of what the Olympic scholars and competitors at the Waldorf School had to say reminds me that children often get it right. When my younger daughter was 6 or 7, she participated in a summer program that took place a couple of evenings a week at the high school track. Several remarkably patient men and women organized it, hoping, I think, that the program might encourage prospective soccer, football, baseball, and basketball players to pay some attention to running and jumping. Maybe these kids would become dedicated sprinters, quarter-milers, and pole vaulters when they reached their teens. I don't know if it worked out that way, but I do remember being amazed at how patient the kids were when they waited and waited and waited for the adults to finish measuring each jump, though the kids would probably have preferred to just keep jumping. I remember that nobody cheated, though it would have been easy to do so, and I remember that though the adults made it clear that winners got blue ribbons and those finishing second got red ones, most of the kids were equally happy to get green, pink, or yellow ribbons, or brown ribbons, or purple ribbons, and some of them traded whatever they won so as to go home with a ribbon of every color. Like the students at the Waldorf School, I've done some research into the Olympics recently, and I discovered that in the early games, to paraphrase something Vince Lombardi is supposed to have said, winning was both everything and the only thing. There were no silver or bronze medals. It strikes me that my daughter and her friends and fellow competitors would have found that an exceptionally dull arrangement. Recently, I've also seen a lot of kids get it right on the basketball court, where my daughter now spends a lot of her time. When games go badly, some of the parents of the players, myself included, get pretty upset. We wonder how the tournament officials could have matched our small, inexperienced girls against this or that aggregation of Amazons, all probably bound for UConn or Tennessee. We assure each other that if they got a fair draw, our kids would do much better. The kids, meanwhile, are doing fine. They play on. For the most part, they smile at their teammates' mistakes and shrug off their own. When one of their number makes a sharp pass or scores, they cheer from the bench, never mind that the basket doesn't pull them to within 25 points of the other team. And at the end of the game, they line up, shake hands, and say nice game to their towering adversaries as if they were just kids like themselves. Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, auto racing's worst year, or at least one that's among them. But first, the news of the week with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The NBA's Western Conference Finals return to Minneapolis tonight. After Thursday's loss in L.A., Kevin Garnett sounded like he had already given up on this series. He said, "You can't be down 3-1 to the Lakers." I hate to sound like a broken record here, but can you find any reason to disagree with him?
Well, first of all, we have to get the epistemological question of what Kevin Garnett said out of the way.
Oops.
When he said, "You can't be down 3-1, he plainly wasn't talking about the possibility of being down 3-1 to the Lakers, because the Timberwolves are down 3-1 to the Lakers. The fascinating thing, of course, about the Lakers is the ongoing Kobe Bryant saga. Game 4, he was in Colorado answering the rape and sexual assault charges. Till an hour before game time, he came in. The Lakers are making a big thing about how they're impressed and inspired by his focus. Now, I'm an innocent until proven guilty guy, so I don't make judgments about Kobe as far as his criminal conduct is complained. But at the same time, because I know nothing about the case, I'm not going to make him a hero yet either. He isn't exactly, setting his own broken leg in three places and injecting himself with morphine and going out there to playing. He's answering criminal charges because he got involved in a situation he should have gotten involved in. Forgive me if I'm not impressed by his focus.
The Philadelphia 76ers brought a horseshoe from Smarty Jones to the NBA draft lottery, Charlie, but it didn't work. I wonder what charm the Orlando Magic, which won the opportunity to pick first, had going for them.
Well, they had Pat Williams dangling on the keychain again. He's won the lottery in 1992 and 93 with Orlando, and in 1986 with Philadelphia. In 92, of course, the pick was Shaquille O'Neal. I just have this wonderful vision of Smarty Jones getting ready for the biggest race of his life in his stall and sort of like limping.
Where's my shoe?
Where's my shoe? Somebody bring back my shoe. How many shoes do I have? Where's my shoe?
Meanwhile, the men's Olympic basketball team has become a little less dreamy.
I'm on it.
Again, Tracy McGrady has joined at least eight other superstars in declining to visit Athens in August. I suppose it's no mystery why millionaires with nothing more to prove might choose not to make that particular trip.
Yeah, there's once again a bit of a boomlet to bring back the college kids so the United States of America can pretend to be an underdog in something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think any invitation should ever be extended to somebody who's already gotten their gold medal, who's already been to the Olympics. I think you get it's a one-shot deal for life. There's no point in trying to get Karl Malone or Reggie Miller or somebody back on the Olympic team. You get the pros you can get, and then you fill the team out with whatever college kids or minor league kids or rookies or whoever you fill it out with. You invite the people. If they decline the invitation, you don't make an issue. You skip down and move on.
Champion sprinter Marion Jones has already threatened to sue anybody who tries to keep her out of the Olympics. This week, her lawyer made public the evidence against her, including his own view of what those documents might mean. I suppose, however, that his assertion that a doping schedule for, quote, MJ, end quote, could pertain to Michael Jackson won't inspire investigations to return to Neverland.
Or Mother Jones, for that matter.
Exactly.
Jordan. Yeah, Marion Jones is going to be the athlete who, depending on your point of view on this whole thing, either stands up or stonewalls the kind of snowballing Balco anti-doping case out in the West Coast. she's got a pretty formidable case. I just don't think she can bring it to a conclusion prior to the end of the Olympics.
The tennis quiz of the week requires folks to, quick, name six players who didn't get knocked out of the French Open in the first two rounds. At last count, nobody could do that. What's going on over
there? Is this still a major? I mean, it's played on a surface nobody likes, nobody cares about, and has been superannuated by equipment and the athletes who play on it. And the French Open is one too many majors for me. It's the PGA of the tennis majors. I don't care.
In reinstating football coach Gary Barnett this week, University of Colorado President Betsy Hoffman said the use of alcohol and sex to recruit players was limited to, quote, a few isolated instances. I don't like to argue semantics on this, but can 9 allegations of rape really be explained away as isolated?
Well, I think what she's meaning is they all didn't take place in, like, the same big room. They all took place in different parts of the campus,
isolated,
so they were isolated from each other. This is stupid. Gary Barnett at this point should be unemployable as a supervisor of young people. 9 women since 1997 have accused Colorado football players of sexual assault. And probably to no one's surprise, renowned Christian nutball Bill McCartney, who preceded Gary Barnett in his sweatshop out there, spoke out in favor of the embattled head coach.
On the other pro football front, the estate of the late Mike Webster, who played for the Pittsburgh Steelers from 1974 until 1989, is suing the NFL's retirement and disability plans, saying football left Webster, quote, punch drunk and unable to function. Is there a case here, and to what extent is this suit likely to have an impact on players in general down the line?
You know, as I think we've talked about before, anybody who opposes boxing as a sport because of the inherent destruction of the human body that's essential to boxing and doesn't oppose professional football for the same reason as a hypocrite. Breaking down the human body is part and parcel of what the National Football League is all about. And if Mike Webster's case gets anywhere and proves anything, it ought to prove that.
This is an ongoing sort of a thing. I mean, the NFL has been infamous for saying, hey, this guy's 50 when he started having problems, and he quit 30 years ago, and so we aren't responsible.
No, of course not, because, you know, the fact that he spent, and let's make it football, too. Let's not just say it's the NFL. The NFL happens to be the profession of playing football, which should take care of its employees after their retirement better than it does. But you've been getting knocked in the head and banged around and had your knees cracked and your hips splintered and your back ruined from the time you're about 15 years old.
At the Home Depot Invitational track meet last weekend, sprinter Maurice Green won the 100-meter event, no surprise there, and then he ripped off his shoes so hurdler Larry Wade could douse them with a fire extinguisher, and he said, my feet were burning, and they had to put the fire out. How much would an NFL player be fined for doing that?
You know what? I liked the cell phone, I liked the Sharpie, and I loved this. I thought this was one of the funniest and most delightful. Imagine being like an 8-year-old in the crowd. Didn't it make you want to run track? Track very cool?
And finally, we come to a sports story that sounds like the pilot for a detective program to me. One of the Formula One cars racing in the Monaco Grand Prix last weekend had a $200,000 diamond embedded in its nose, in the nose of the car. The car crashed, and the diamond has gone missing. And it may mean nothing, but George Clooney, Brad Pitt, and Matt Damon were all at that race.
Imagine being like the racing bleacher bum who's sitting there, and if you're really lucky, the tire that comes loose doesn't hit you in the head and you can take a piece of it home. And this car hits the wall and you look down at your feet and there's a diamond. What did these people think was going to happen to the diamond? They put it in the front of a race car.
Charlie Pierce, who writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Where's my diamond? Where's my shoe?
The gentlemen starting their engines tomorrow for the Indianapolis 500 will set no records for fuel efficiency. IRL IndyCar Series cars get a little less than 2 miles to a gallon of fuel, which is methanol, by the way, so don't feel too smug when you pull up to the pump this weekend. According to Central Indiana law enforcement authorities, tomorrow's race will set records in terms of the number of security personnel trackside. The Indy 500 of 49 years ago became infamous for the deaths associated with it. In fact, 1955 was such a spectacularly bad year for driving fast that Car and Driver editor and columnist Brock Yates felt compelled to write a book about the various disasters crammed into that year. The result, Against Death and Time, is rife with carnage and crashing on and off the racetrack. Brock Yates joins me now from the studios of North Country Public Radio. Mr. Yates, welcome to Only a Game.
Nice to be here, Bill, believe me.
Against Death and Time chronicles the stories of a particularly disastrous Indy 500 race, a Grand Prix at Le Mans in which driver deaths were far outnumbered by spectator deaths, and finally the death of movie star James Dean in his Porsche. What connects these events beyond the fact that they all happened in 1955?
Well, I think it was a sea change, Bill, in many ways in how we viewed not only racing and the dangers involved therein, but also we linked it through a narrator who travels the world to kind of view these things on a much like Desmond Morris did, by the way, in his biography of Ronald Reagan called Dutch.
Your narrator spent some time talking to racing journalist Peter Coltran, an actual person, who suggests at one point that maybe people complicate racing unnecessarily. You have Coltran say, quote, "Thinking too much is not good. Stab it and steer it." Does that strategy essentially apply among racers today?
No, not at all. It's become a much more highly technical sport, very much involved in engineering and computer simulations. And the racing driver of today is a much, much more cerebral, if I may use that word, individual. For example, many of the NASCAR drivers are pretty well-educated guys. Ryan Newman, for example, who's one of the very best, is a Purdue engineering graduate. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we've got a totally different breed of individual competing today versus what we had 50 years ago. And, of course, the idea that we would lose, in some cases, over half the field of starters over the course of their careers would be absolutely intolerable today. We could not in any way tolerate a sport that lost half its participants. We wouldn't deal with that. We could not deal with that, I don't think.
How did they deal with it then?
They just kind of brushed it off as the price of doing business. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, these people climbed into these racing cars in 1955, basically essentially wearing street clothes. The Europeans would not use seat belts because they felt that it was safer to get pitched out of the car if it crashed. The crash helmets were absolutely rudimentary. There were no roll bars. In fact, the drivers in those days felt that roll bars were unsightly. They felt they ruined the looks of the car. It's a mindset that involved risk-taking way, way, way beyond anything we would tolerate today, which I found one of the reasons that I was fascinated with the era and with the moment.
Getting back to the structure of the book, your narrator has a girlfriend, at least briefly, who follows the racing circuit. She's kind of a racing groupie, and she says at one point that she likes racing because, quote, "Hollywood is plastic, and this is real." Is it the risks that she has in mind when she says real? What does she mean by that?
I'm sure she does, yes. I'm sure that the walking on the ragged edge, or living on the ragged edge, is what attracted her, and I think what attracted an awful lot of people. Remember, Bill, that a lot of these individuals in 1955 participating in motor racing were veterans, and they had come home from World War II to a relatively placid society. We remember the 50s as this kind of very pastel-colored, very kind of peaceful, seamless kind of living in America, which David Halberstam articulated very well in his book, The 50s, and other that criticized this sort of very, very kind of soft living that was coming out of World War II. There was an edge to these men and women, in some cases women, very few though, but for the most part, these guys wanted to live on the edge. They had grown up as young men in fighting in Europe, in the Pacific, and came home to this very, very placid society. And I think there was very much a reaction to that.
In the race at Le Mans, one of the cars, a Mercedes, crashes, as you had mentioned, and large parts of it, two large parts of it, sail into the crowd, killing scores of spectators. Did that disaster at least lead directly to changes in the way that sort of race was run?
Yes, it led to massive alterations in racetrack design around the world. Yes, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway was altered radically to protect the crowds. Designers were brought in to protect spectators from not only from flying shrapnel, but also from automobiles. Switzerland outlawed racing forever. France and Germany temporarily outlawed it until it was made safer for spectators. The Le Mans crash had a radical impact on spectator safety and also in many ways on automotive safety as well.
The final death that you dramatize in this book happens when James Dean wrecks his car, as you mentioned, not in competition, but in a high-speed accident with another car at an intersection. Why did you include that event in a book that is essentially set in auto racing?
Well, because he was a motor racing enthusiast. He was on his way to a motor race at Salinas, California, and he was quite a talented driver. His basic avocation was racing. He had only raced three times prior to that, but he was a vividly talented young man as a race driver. And he had mentioned to friends that if and when his movie career was over, he wanted to race more actively. So he personified very much the kind of instincts to compete in a racing car, very much like the more professional drivers that I talked about elsewhere. But Dean was very much a racer. He was a full-tilt race driver. It just so happened that he had his accident on the public highways as opposed to a racetrack.
After 1955, your narrator falls away from the world of automobile racing. He turns to writing TV sitcoms, in fact, and he says, quote, "Their feathery plot lines and inane dialogue helped erase memories of death and carnage." I'm sure the people who work for TV aren't thrilled by that, but my question is, have you ever been tempted to escape racing's darker side that way yourself?
Well, I do confess, I've never written sitcoms, but I have done a few television scripts, and of course I wrote the movie Cannonball Run, and my representation in Hollywood is, I guess, at that level, Bill.
Inane
party
stuck out.
Inane, yes, there you go. That is it.
Brock Yates is the author of Against Death and Time, published by Thunder's Mouth Press. Brock, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Parati. We had help this week from Joel Hurd at North Country Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallet. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again or see photos from the Waldorf School Olympics, visit our website, onlyagame.org. In our final word, Waldorf fifth grade teacher Tara De Natale explains the real role of Hercules in the creation of the Olympics.
He could have been their spin doctor, I think, or their advertiser.
Gee, a demigod leading the marketing team. I guess the goal of the ancient Olympics was pretty much the same as the goal nowadays. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Headquarters, we are still in pursuit of the black Lamborghini.
You've been in pursuit for 2 hours. Another 5 minutes and you'll be in Arizona.
Yeah, and we're going to stay in pursuit until we catch him.
It didn't take us that long to catch Dillinger.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal-treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.